time that you've worked, how have you noticed those farmers and their communities being affected by kind of global commodity prices or kind of what's happening in the global industrial
cycle? Yeah, I mean, they tend
cycle.
You know, there tends to be real waves where a government sees a nice price in cotton. They make a drive with their ag extension service to get cotton promoted, you know, and then the price falls, and all of a sudden, everybody steps back. Yeah, and farmers are out there with a crop that they've worked, and the price that they get paid is minimal. I mean, and that hurts them, and then they switch to something else. Yeah, that's not as bad as sugarcane, where that happens.
Right.
When you've invested in 3 or 4 years of getting this plantation going, and it may only be a 2-acre plantation, I don't mean a big one.
Right.
You know, and then there's no reward for it.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, you've invested over a period of time. And the tendency for something like that is not to give up on it because you put in this investment. So so you try it again, and 2 or 3 years before you say,
right,
give up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, let's dig all this stuff back up.
Mm-hmm. So they're heavily influenced. I mean, actually, what they're growing is influenced by kind of what people are telling them to grow.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and that happens through first the government that is looking for foreign exchange off of, I mean, because there are resource, most of the poorer countries in the world are resource sales. They get their foreign exchange through the sale of resources, whether it's minerals or agricultural projects. If they don't have petroleum or minerals, it's usually agricultural products.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if they see an opportunity to sell cotton, you know, they'll push it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the government maintains a margin in there, you know, that is their means of getting foreign exchange into the treasury. And, you know, I mean, the U.S. goes around the world preaching that we shouldn't have government-run monopolies and things, but, you know, I mean, they go so far, but, yeah, I mean, yeah, and one of the problems is they're not very responsive. I mean, they push and they don't, you know, give up, but the farmers don't give up right away either when the price comes down, and the farmers, you know, in Timbuktu don't know the price is going down as fast as the farmer in Illinois knows the price is going down, and you can't quite shift quite as quickly. You know, so that lag, you know, wherever you are in the world hurts. It sure isn't that government who's going to take it on the chin. They're going to watch the prices drop and they'll peg their price down a little lower. That they buy. And there's no competition. So, the farmer has to sell it to them.
So, it sounds like there's two things going on, because one is kind of this, some more technical production problems that are part of what your organization addresses, you know, which has to do with having higher yields and kind of the technology they're using on the farm. And then another part of it is, you know, kind of the global commodity system, which has these price, you know, hikes and peaks and valleys and, you know.
Usually levels of production in traditional agricultural communities is about 1/3 of what you can get at an experiment station. Yeah,
so in the same country with the same.
Yeah, in the same ecozone.
With similar technology.
With
non-industrialized kind of simple.
Yeah, I mean there may be some basic fertilizer or whatever, but largely it's timeliness and density plantings and. I mean, just basic agricultural principles. Why doesn't it happen? I mean, it's hard to get out there and get 3 hectares planted, and weeded, before it's overtaken by something or another by hand.
By hand, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you could be more timely with a tractor, but 3 hectares isn't enough to merit the investment in a tractor.
Right.
You know, so can't we find some intermediate means to provide, you know, the power to get it done on a timely basis, maybe even to get some fertilizer nutrients recycled back in, you know, from the animals or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, weeding has been a major challenge because it's usually women and children's work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we do a little better job in, you know, getting area increased, and we've just loaded women and children with more weeding work.
Mm-hmm.
And that means, you know, that the weeding is going to be done later. It's important to get these crops weeded when they're just little seedlings out there. If you wait until, you know, the weed competition is up like this,
mm-hmm.
you've lost a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And tropic rain seasons don't make it easy to do weeding.
Mm-hmm.
And herbicides are not readily available, are not cost effective. I mean, it's many times yet it's more cost effective to hire somebody to weed than it is to pay for herbicides,
mm-hmm.
because labor is so cheap.
Mm.
But having cheap labor is not the way we get out of this situation. I mean, mm-hmm. I think we need to value our labor, and value the labor of others enough so that everybody can live a little better life.
Mm-hmm. And do you see that happening in the communities you're working, or? How does the quality of life improve from these practices? I mean, they're getting more productivity, which means they're probably getting more for their crop.
Yeah, I mean, if they're getting more, money, and just because. Well, first of all, we tell them, don't forget the food crops. You can market those locally. You don't have to depend on a marketing board somewhere. And you're still going to have fluctuation in price, but it's local competition that you're usually dealing with. And most of the crops that we export, that is, we want Africa to grow peanuts and cotton. Mm-hmm. Why do we want them to grow peanuts and cotton? Because it's terribly labor intensive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and with animal power, we cannot really touch we can touch it, but we can't resolve the labor intensity of that harvest process.
Mm-hmm.
It's great to have cotton hand-picked because you can get better fiber and whatever else,
mm-hmm.
But nobody's willing to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
The real value of that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way we can get a $300,000 cotton picker over there.
Uh-huh.
You had to do it mechanically.
So a lot of it is, is a good kind of qualitative chunk of your work, just working with people to determine what to plant and what makes sense to plant, and
we watch that to some extent, but we largely leave that to them.
Uh-huh.
We encourage them not to forget, these, basic food crops in their system. I mean, mm-hmm. don't be too quick to listen to that government agent who's coming around saying, this year cotton is great, or this year sesame or whatever. They're mix it.
Mm-hmm.
Keep them mix. And the nice thing about, the animal power is that it can be directed to multiple crops.
Mm-hmm.
It's not focused on a single crop. It's not a technology that's just best for that.
Like such as a combine for a specific grain or whatever.
A particular herbicide or some fertilizer.
Right, highly specialized agriculture.
The fertilizers usually are high in phosphate for something or high in nitrogen for maize or something. I'm not answering your questions very directly.
No, it's good. It's good. I just had a little brain fart. But what I was thinking was that it just came back to me. It seems that maybe, you know, what people grow, it also has to be, kind of a coordinated effort, right? Because, like, you don't have everyone in a village growing something different. Wouldn't it be kind of a collective decision, like, okay, well, as a group, we're going to grow sesame so that we can all kind of market this, right? Because you need to take it somewhere and sell it to someone. And so isn't that generally done kind of in a somewhat coordinated fashion among farmers?
If it's a new crop, then you'll probably have an NGO, a non-government organization, or an extension agent coming in and trying to get farmers to do group work. The general practice is to have a fairly uniform mix of crops, like 10% rice, 20% cotton, 25% sorghum, 25% maize. And many farmers will have a mix very similar to that, and they'll all be doing it on their private small fields. There is the group concept as well, production groups, and those are usually focused on where they're introducing a new technology, and it's easier for an extension agent to yell at everybody from a central plant. I mean, that's a cynical plan. But there's still some yelling that's happening out there. At people rather than coaching. I think it's just a waste of effort. Because people get offended and they walk away and they shut up their ears. I mean, if you work with them as intelligent human beings, they will feel flattered and pleased, and they'll respond a lot better.
So it sounds like you're speaking to kind of a common cultural phenomenon of the extension people thinking that they're... Are they called extension in those countries? Or is that just kind of like an easy way to understand who they are?
Well, I mean, they're called some version of that.
Yeah. Is there a general kind of attitude of, arrogance or, like, superiority or whatever? Kind of, we know better than you do, and we'll tell you what to plant.
Historically, there's been, for a number of years, ex-colonial people were, played significant roles within... after the colonial period, after 1960.
Post-colonial,
After 1960, people who had significant colonial training, stepped into these foreign leadership roles of, whether it was the French or the British or whatever. And so the National Extension Services usually had European and American researchers running them. And, their form of vulgarization or spreading, the knowledge around diffusion of information was rather harsh.
Rather coercive.
And it was simply, it's a recipe, do it. One, two, three. That's simple. Get it done.
Right.
It wasn't. This is why you need to get it done. If you can figure out a better way to do it, go for it.
So did that create like a certain amount of? I mean, the word chaos I was going to use, but I mean, it sounds like you have a lot of people kind of being coerced or feeling coerced, and then maybe you have other people resisting that, and so people are growing different crops.
What is subsistence agriculture about?
Subsisting.
Yeah, but it's not just that. it's withdrawing from the system.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they have made conscious decisions to withdraw from the system.
The people who you work with?
Who are truly subsistence agriculturalists.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
so they've been to where they were attached to the system,
they've
and they've
been
made
burnt,
a decision.
They've reached out, they've tried, their hands are burned, you know, by one thing or another, and they pull back to, okay, we'll just do what we need to do.
And you think that's pretty common around the world?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, so, yeah. I mean, but, you know, even to get oxen or to get a credit for $50 plow or something like that is reaching out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there has to be a certain amount of confidence that, okay, I can do this, and they don't have a grasp on me. Yeah, I mean, this is something I can use in five different ways. I don't have to use it on cotton. I don't have to use it on, you know, whatever, you know, the crop of the day is. You know, and, you know, so I'm still free to manage it. I mean, you end up, well, yeah. I mean, in West Africa, the nomadic herds people, the Fulani, you know, in an area where I was in the Peace Corps, you know, they were doing pretty well with cattle selling and things, and their kids started to buy motorbikes. And then the police started to come by and find all kinds of reasons why, you know, they should take these motorbikes away. So the fathers got together and said, no more motorbikes, kids. You know, they're an attractive nuisance. They're drawing the police here. And
they're just going to steal
that attention.
You
know, so they got that. There are a lot of... Yeah, instances of that occur. Yes, I think it's good for us to be working in, and you know, there's a young woman working in Commodity Commission for Ethiopia. To get a local base for, you know, happening. But I don't think it's a solo answer. I mean.
Get a local, I'm sorry.
A local marketing of commodities, yeah, within Ethiopia. Yeah,
so that it's not all for export.
White is controlled by foreign movements.
Yeah.
Yeah, but...
So your kind of task or your goals are to almost help increase people's level of freedom.
Yeah, and to empower them within their community to
be able to make those choices for themselves and have the tools to do that.
And I mean, it comes with 1,000 little pieces of knowledge and skill.
Right,
and farming
it's pretty
is a
complex.
Very complex. Yeah,
and then you throw in all the social dynamics.
Oh,
wow. Intercultural and economic.
Sociology and political science and economics.
It's all
life,
in there.
Life is a challenge, and that's what makes it interesting.
Yeah. Could you just comment a little bit on, because part of what we're looking at is like alternatives to kind of annual grain production, and I know that, you know, most of the world relies on staple grains. But, you know, looking more at almost like, or have you seen any kind of agroforestry or perennial polycultures or, you know, anything kind of permacultural or anything of that nature?
There are millions of mango trees around the world,
I mean, are people actually, like,
are they
besides
fully
for,
making a living off of permacultures?
Well, not even that, but I mean, are they making a good chunk of it? I mean, are they I know that, I mean, for my travels, like in Latin America, I've seen, you know, people plant all kinds of stuff around their house, and
yeah.
It's not like here where it's just a big field of grain.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's like, you know, probably
but,
know,
I mean,
over
50%. If you go into some of the hill country of places like Uganda, there's a tremendous amount of plantains because that's a major starch. Yeah, mm-hmm. And that's, they thank their grandparents for that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for planting them.
Right.
Yeah, that's a long-term investment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on where you are. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, we're all fighting those struggles. I mean, whether it's, here, or whatever. I mean, here we're able to do a lot of grass-based stuff, but, that's not a basic food. I mean, meat is a luxury, that most of us don't respect it as that, but...
How about in terms of, in a, like, really solid rotational grazing system, I mean, can it be a competitive, in terms of like calories per acre, can it be competitive with grain? Or, is it still luxury in that case? Or?
I don't know the scientific answer to that.
What's your answer?
Well, yeah, I mean, for one thing, we use marginal lands. I mean, here all the hill land is kept in perennial cover, largely alfalfa, because we can get 9 years out of that before we have to replant it. So we're out there cutting it and putting it away without tillage. We probably feed, two animals per acre of that, which is pretty good here. And then questions we can switch to, how efficiently are you using the animals that you've just fed? And that's largely, milk and meat. And now, we're putting draft back in the formula, but, But, there's some, good, grass-fed dairies that are doing pretty well. Cost-wise. They're putting in fewer inputs, therefore they don't have to get as many outputs in order to make a profit.
Right. Have you heard of Mark Shepherd's farm in Wisconsin?
No.
He grows hazelnuts and chestnuts. And he also has, cane fruit and apples. And he's getting, he's just now getting mechanical harvesting equipment in place to harvest those with shakers. And, he coppices them. So he's saying, I just plant my crop once and I never have to plant it again for, 400 years.
Yeah. Trees are great.
Pretty interesting. And he also has many different sources of income because of the variety of
A few years ago, Michigan State University did a study of comparing corn production to local farm woodlots.
Even just woodlots.
Yeah. And what? Wow.
Woodlots were more profitable.
Woodlots were more profitable.
Yeah,
because,
I bet.
Because there was no management or annual cost.
Yeah, corn's just probably about the worst thing you could grow. Well, any other thoughts?
Every time you ask a question, there'll be a thought. But
yeah.
I better let it go.
Well, thanks so much.
Yeah.